contact both their offices with any questions or anything else that you may want to, or set up any kind of appointments with them. Okay, thank you.
So as I spoke before, I'm Christopher Carreri. I'm a regional director with Prudential Advisors. Today, me and Carrie had discussed that we're going to kind of break this up a little bit. I'm going to kind of do a little small presentation at the beginning, then I'm going to turn over to Carrie, and then I'll kind of close it out with just some kind of takeaways that you might be able to kind of follow up on, just as a family that may need to do planning for an individual with special needs. So I normally like to start this off with something that, and I use a lot of examples from my family and from clients. And what I can say is the one thing that I found useful over the years is talking about a letter of intent or a letter of instruction. I'd mentioned that my sister has special needs, and my sister is high functioning, but again, she has to be extremely regimented. About 10 years ago, my parents decided to retire. And their biggest challenge in retirement was obviously planning for my sister. And unbeknownst to me, my mom had been working on something about 20 years ago. She went to a workshop and someone had said, if something happens to you, is the next person really going to know everything about your loved one and how to care for them? And this letter of intent started off, my mom originally started almost 20 years ago, and it turned into a binder. And this binder was 15 subsections. And it went over everything for my sister, from the types of food she likes, the type of hobbies that she does, how to contact these people. It was almost an instruction of care. And when my mom and dad decided to retire, in 2010, me and my brother were in a very different situation than obviously 20 years ago. And my mom and dad sat the two of us down and they said, we really could use your help. My mom had showed us how she had kind of put everything in place where a lot of the things for my sister was automated. And as she kind of sat down and educated us on this workbook, or this, it's a trapper keeper. We had gotten a lot of information specifically on how to specifically care for my sister and how to find the right people that assist us in this. As I started working with Prudential, obviously I was learning more and more about special needs planning and sitting down with families that have children or adults with special needs. And what I found, an overall theme, was a lot of the families didn't have this type of information readily available. And again, I was talking to a lot of these clients saying, what happens if something happens to you and your husband? And then what would happen to your daughter? They kind of look at you like, well, we think we know who would take care of her. I'm like, that's great. But do you know specifically, depending upon their disability or challenges, is there kind of a playbook in place? And as I started working with more and more of my clients, we started to create these type of letters of instruction, letter of intent, and we actually made it part of their financial plan. So what ends up happening is, God forbid something were to happen to either the husband or wife, or the married couple, I should say, either together or separately, we had something in place that could give anyone else outside of that family or outside of that close-knit group that would give them instructions on specifically how to do this. And again, this is not something that's overly cumbersome or something that's difficult. It's really just taking the time and building it. And what I mean by building it, it's not something you write on one like long afternoon in the wintertime. It's something that's going to evolve over time and something that's going to change. And as this changes, it just helps the family members and the individuals specifically not change your routine. And using my sister as a good example, like, my sister has a very specific taste in clothing. And if she doesn't have that specific brand, it could be a very big problem for us. And learning that, it was something that was integral. And then, as I started going through this kind of instruction guide that my mom had created for me and my brother to help out with my sister, we kind of looked at it that my mom had laid everything out for us. And it was probably one of the most useful things ever. Now, obviously, if you're the caregivers of this individual, you know these type of things on a day-to-day basis. But, you have to look at it for a more long-term picture. 9 years ago, I was brought in to a case with a family where there's an individual. He was 50 years old. His wife was 52. And he had an older cousin that the aunt was taking care of him. And he was, at the time, I believe, 62. Yeah, because he's now 73. The interesting thing about it was, and his name's William, and he is the happiest person I've ever met, and he's a great person to speak to. But his cousin, Rob, did not have any instructions or anything. So the first couple of years, it was very difficult to get, you know, his cousin William on a schedule and whatnot and pattern. And we sat down and we wrote this all out. Now Rob has become a complete advocate that any person he meets inside the network that where William's living now, he makes it a point to tell every single guardian or parent, you know, take a look and see what we did. It's going to be absolutely godsend to you that God forbid if something happens to you. I mean, Rob didn't know that he was the guardian of William when his aunt passed away. He didn't know anything about William other than the fact that he knew that he was slightly cognitively impaired. Other than that, he didn't know his daily routines and whatnot. And like I had mentioned, it was a real struggle for several years. You know, having that specific guideline or that framework for any family, it's going to be an absolute integral part of anything. And working as a financial planner, it really is just, it's a financial plan, but it's really more of a care plan. And that's where working with the right advisor, right financial planner, and the right legal team, and also the right tax team, you can build a very, very strong and sound, you know, financial future and this emotional and caregiving future for these individuals. So again, I kind of wanted to kind of open this up with just a little bit of information, a tidbit of things you might want to be aware of. And again, I use my personal family and my clients' experiences to kind of paint that picture really well for individuals. But again, this is something that if you have additional questions, you can always feel free to contact me. And I'm going to, you know, at the end of this presentation, I'm also going to go into a little more detail about something else to be aware of. But I think the real crust or the real meat and potatoes of this presentation is really going to be Carrie. So at this point, I do want to give her as much time as possible so that she can educate as many of you as possible also. And like I mentioned, I'll come on a little later on in the presentation and I can talk about another factor or another piece of the pie that you might want to be more aware of. So at this point, I'm going to mute my phone. I'm going to take the video off. I'm going to turn this over to Carrie.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
So I'm going to talk about guardianships, and I'm going to talk about, you know, what you need to become a guardian and try to give you a little bit of the framework. There's many different types of guardians. There's Article 81 of the Mental Hygiene Law, which is Supreme Court, governs guardianship. Most of the time that is for elderly people or people who have lost capacity at some point. Article 17A of the Surrogates Court Procedure Act governs guardianship of adults who are diagnosed with an intellectual or developmental disability. And I'm just going to read to you what the Article 17A, which is 1750A says, and then I'll go into more layman's terms about it. But it basically says that an intellectually disabled adult is defined by the Surrogates Court Procedure Act as one who is permanently or indefinitely incapable of managing oneself and or one's own affairs because of an intellectual disability. And the intellectual disability can be defined as somebody who has a developmental disability that's permanent or indefinite and must be attributable to either cerebral palsy, epilepsy, neurological impairment, autism, traumatic brain injury, or any other condition to be found to be closely related to the intellectual disability. And the condition must have originated before the person became the age of 22, except for traumatic brain injury, which has no age limit. So what happens with guardianship is that when we think of our children, and especially our special needs children, as our child, and it will always be our child, but we worry about our children, typical or with special needs, as any parent would, as to, you know, where are they going to be in this world and how are we going to help them. When our special needs child turns 18, what we sometimes forget is that they are now an adult and they have an ability to make decisions for themselves. And if your child who is now becoming 18 has this disability that would prevent them from making decisions for themselves or making decisions that are not going to be considered because of their disability is impairing their decision-making, then there is a need to become a guardian. So what happens is that even simply going to the doctor. There's two types of guardians. There's guardians for personal needs and there's guardians for property management. So the guardians for personal needs make decisions such as medical decisions, going to the doctor. Are they going to take some tests? Are they going to do an MRI? And if your intellectually disabled or developmentally disabled adult cannot make those decisions for himself or herself, then you need to become their guardian. So people will say, well, I am their mother, I'm their father, I'm their guardian. No, not according to the law. So you have to go to court, you have to go to the surrogate's court, and you have to petition the court to become the guardian. Also, if that child who's now becoming an adult at the age of 18 has funds or monies in his or her name, then you need to become the property management guardian, which is the guardian who takes care of handling the finances. And then you have to report to the court on an annual basis as to what you've done with the funds. So right today, I'm going to try give you just some information, even if you just needed to become the personal needs guardian. You need to petition the court, like I said, and you need to be able to provide many documents. And you need most times you need the advice of an attorney to help you navigate the system. There is an ability for people to do this pro se, which means without an attorney and on their own. And the court can assist you to some degree, but the court can't give you advice. So you need to be able to have everything in order and be ready to do this yourself. There is also, after the paperwork is filed and the affidavits are prepared, there will be a hearing, which is basically where you're going to the courtroom. And you are saying to the judge with your intellectually disabled adult that there is a need for a guardianship. And in Queens County, the surrogate Kelly is a wonderful person who is able to really understand the needs of the people. And it's not something that you should be scared about, because he understands the situation and will help you get the guardian appointed. But the condition of the person that has made them disabled has to be certified by a licensed physician and a licensed psychologist, or by two licensed physicians, one who has a familiarity with and the knowledge and care and treatment of the person. So what I would suggest to people as you're preparing for this is if you went on to the website of the Queens Surrogate Court and looked under 17-A guardianship, there is a proceedings checklist and it tells you certain things that you need, such as the original birth certificate of the person that you're looking and seeking to become the guardian for. It tells you who has to be interested in the proceeding as an interested party, such as both parents of the person, such as whoever lives in the household with the person, such as siblings, the adult siblings of the person with special needs. And what you have to remember is that this is a process. So there is a lot of paperwork. And what we are basically doing under 17A is removing the adult's right to make legal decisions for his or her own affairs. So the court doesn't take this lightly. And you look at it and you say, well, of course this person needs a guardian. What I want to bring just for purposes of discussion is there was recently in Kings County, the surrogate, there was a decision that came down, which was very, very informative in the sense that this decision decided that the petition for guardianship was denied. This was a mom who was petitioning for her 19-year-old daughter who had autism, but the daughter was extraordinarily high functioning, was going to a college program, which did have an ability to help children with special needs. But the court felt that at this point, there were other less restrictive means to be able for this daughter to take on what she needed to in decision-making in her lifetime. And although, so this is something that I want to point out that we need to explore. You need to explore that whether your child does need a guardian or whether there are other means such as power of attorney and healthcare proxy. And of course, always remembering that we don't want to have somebody sign those things who doesn't understand what they're signing. But there are different realms of what type of capacity somebody has to do those documents. So what I think is important is that you need to have a physician and the backing of physicians or psychologists who can say to you, somebody needs a guardian or they don't need a guardian. And you yourself will know whether there is an ability for your person that is in your life to be able to make those decisions for you. Like I wanted to talk about with guardianship. So if there's a determination that there is a need for a guardian and you're going to petition the court, again, there's a lot of information that has to be prepared and brought together, such as names, addresses, et cetera, of the people that are residing with the intellectually disabled person or developmentally disabled person. There also has to be some decisions making of who is going to be the guardian for the person. And again, this is you, if you are the parent and that's what you want to do and you're able to do it during your lifetime, or both parents, or one parent's going to do it and one's going to be a successor. But then after that, you can have what we call a standby or a first alternate standby or a second alternate standby. So those actually have to be persons who are adults. And I'm sure sometimes our first child is the child with the developmental disability, and our younger child, who would probably be the younger child who's almost like the little big sister or little big brother, would be the perfect person, but they're not 18 yet. So there is an ability with the court system to at a later date, after maybe you have an aunt or uncle is the standby person, to then change that when your other child may be the right person to take care of the developmentally disabled child. The court, you know, has an ability for you to do this. Again, there is always, you have to go back into court, you have to petition the court, which means you have to ask them to have somebody else become the successor guardian. And everybody has to agree, meaning the one person who's coming out from being the first guardian has to agree to say, I will let somebody else be in my place. There also is worries about what are we going to do when we have a intellectually disabled person or developmentally disabled person who has funds in their name, and how these funds may interrupt their governmental entitlements and other benefits that they have. So there is a need to look to do planning for that person. If there are funds that are in their name that they've inherited some money from Aunt Sue, and Aunt Sue didn't realize that she shouldn't give money to Joey because Joey was receiving benefits and now Joey comes into this money. So say many times I have it that Joey turns 18, mom and dad have gone to the court, they have petitioned to become the guardian for Joey of the person. At the time Joey was 18, there was no funds he was receiving. He might have been receiving Social Security disability benefits, but mom was the representative payee, meaning that she and Social Security had come to an agreement that she was a successful person to be able to be the payee, and that Social Security paid Joey's benefits to that person. But now Aunt Sue has left this money to Joey, and what are we going to do? Because now Joey can't have $30,000 in his name because it will interrupt his benefits. So what needs to happen is that Joey, mom has to go to court, and now she has to modify the guardianship so that she is not just the personal needs guardian for Joey, but also the property management guardian. At the same time, when the court gives her authority to be in charge of funds for Joey, she may need to create something called a supplemental needs trust, and whereby she has to ask the court for permission to create this trust, which will allow the funds that Joey has in his name to be transferred to the name of the trust. And that will enable Joey to be able to continue his governmental benefits entitlements that he's receiving. So there are different steps that go along with the process. But again, the process begins with always petitioning the court. And when you are a guardian of the property, once you have funds that are in your name, the court has joint control of those funds. And therefore, those go into an account that's held jointly with the parents and the court, which means that anytime there is a withdrawal from this account, there is a need to get approval of the court by a short form order to get approval to withdraw funds. A lot of times people find it that it's an easier path that once there are funds in the person's name to create the supplemental needs trust, besides the fact that the supplemental needs trust will enable the person to continue their benefits. But we want to always have the ability then to be able to pay for things from these funds from the trust account so that the trust is supplementing the person's life. And if they have hobbies or other things that they want to do, this trust will enable them to do that. So to recap in the sense of what are your first steps and what are the things that you need to do? Well, first of all, again, we need to determine that yes, a guardianship is necessary. And if somebody is turning 18 and they cannot make medical or financial decisions for themselves, you're going to go into court and ask to become the guardian of the person and or the property management. If there are no funds that are in the person's name, then you don't need a property management guardian at this time. After that, if funds come into that person's name, then again, you can ask the court to modify the guardianship so that there will be also a guardian of the property management. There are times when now a sibling of the intellectually disabled person has become of age themselves where they would be an appropriate guardian. And that time you can also ask the court to amend the order and the decree of guardianship to replace that person. Remembering, like I said, this case that I referred to that was in Kings County, that we have to make sure that these are the least restrictive measures because we are taking away the person's ability to make decisions for themselves. But, and like I said to you earlier, the paperwork and things that you need to complete are on the website of the Surrogates Court in Queens County. And there are lists of what things you need to get in order. And that probably is the best place to start just for you to look at things to say, okay, what do I need? And if you're going to an attorney to help you with this process, that would be a good start to put all of this information together. It becomes an overwhelming process for many, I know, but you have to break it down in steps as you get the letters from the doctor, the address of the family members and everything else, it will all fall into place. And at the end of the day, you will have safeguarded the ability to make the decisions for the person who's vulnerable and who needs somebody important in their life to make those decisions. Is there any other questions or a certain area that somebody wants me to address a little bit further?
Okay, I see a question.
Right, I'm trying to...
Oh, sorry.
No, it's okay. You go ahead. I wondered if I was supposed to go down there. Okay.
Is it better to create supplemental needs trust before guardianship?
Okay. So a supplemental needs trust, there are different types of supplemental needs trust. So I'll talk a little bit about that. So there are what we call self-settled supplemental needs trust and third-party supplemental needs trust. So what does self-settled mean? Self-settled means that the disabled person has funds in his or her name. Therefore, that person doesn't have the capacity to create the trust on their own, to sign the documents. So therefore, you need to have a guardian appointed to create the supplemental needs trust. And that guardian has to get court approval, and the trust has to be presented to the court for approval. When a trust is what we call a supplemental, a self-settled supplemental needs trust, it has what we have call a payback provision, meaning Joey came into money. Joey is not supposed to have money in his name because he's receiving these governmental entitlements. You are asking the court to appoint a guardian, or if a guardian's been appointed already, the guardian asking the court to create this trust and to fund the trust with Joey's inheritance that he's just received from Aunt Sue. In that trust document, what's required under the law is that the ultimate beneficiary of that trust, meaning if there are funds in that trust at the time of Joey's passing 100 years from now, those funds have to go back to the agency and governmental entity that has been providing the benefits to Joey during his lifetime. So those are paid back, as opposed to a third party supplemental needs trust, meaning mom and dad create a will. Under the will, mom and dad say, my portion of the money that's going to Joey is going to be in a trust so that it doesn't interfere with his benefits. And that can be any amount of money in that trust. But that's a third party, meaning mom and dad, creating the trust for Joey, not Joey self-settling the trust. And the beneficiary of the third party trust can be whoever mom and dad want. So if there are funds in there, those funds are to be used during Joey's lifetime for therapeutic benefits, for entertainment, for going to ball games, for buying additional clothing, etc., whatever is needed for Joey. And at the end of the day, if Joey's sister Sally is alive, she can be the beneficiary of that trust. So an answer to your question is, unless the supplemental needs trust is being created by the parent, whether it be under a will or as a standalone document, then that can be done, but that's not going to be created with the developmentally disabled individual's funds. If it's created with that person's funds, then unless they have the capacity to create the trust, there's a need for court intervention.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Sure.
We have some individuals who are the recipients of like medical malpractice awards from birth, and money may have been put into a different type of trust that may not have been done by a special needs attorney many years ago. How does a parent switch those funds into a trust so that their child can be eligible for government benefits?
Okay, so then the parent, if that trust is considered a self-settled, or settled and created with funds that belong to the disabled person, mm-hmm. and then that trust or that parent as the guardian or the guardian of the individual, I should say, has to go into court and ask for permission to create a supplemental needs trust that would be in accordance with the laws and rules. And that type of trust would have that payback provision in it. So there would be a need for court intervention again. And a lot of times that happens where there are malpractice actions that occur, and then there is a need to go to court to get the ability to create the trust that will be in accordance with the language to not prohibit them from continuing to receive their benefits.
Thank you.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Basile, thank you. This has been really wonderful to listen to. Carrie, I have a son who has, at the age of 18, I got him guardianship. Now I want to change his guardianship. I want to change it to somebody completely different on the listing, because now his sister is willing to take on the guardianship. She is much younger than him. I was told the whole process had to be redone.
So yes, what you have to do is, if you have a decree of guardianship from the court that appoints yourself and maybe somebody else to be the successor guardian, you need to petition the court to, what we say, amend the decree to appoint your daughter as the successor instead of the other person that you might have had. And basically what happens is, in doing that, the person who was your successor, who was already determined by the court to be the appropriate person in the event something happens to the first guardian, that successor has to consent to being removed. But yes, it's not redoing the entire process. We are not proving to the court that the person is disabled or is in need of a guardian. What we're basically doing is proving to the court that the new person that's coming in should be the new person, and then that person meets the qualifications for being the guardian and then having the consent of the other person. And if the other person doesn't consent, well, then it becomes a more complex proceeding, because you need to prove to the court that your daughter, who you're referring to, who wants to take on the guardianship now, is the right person and is better off than the other person that you had as a successor.
Okay, just mine was done by a lawyer, and I wasn't advised that you cannot take on a person who doesn't live in the United States. So I have a guardian who doesn't live in this country, and I wasn't advised that was not a sensible thing to do. Now I'm told I have to send all that information back to her and back here. And it has to be done some legally?
Yes, because there are documents that need to be signed by the person who's being removed. And if those documents would have to be signed before a notary, and if they're in a different country, then they have to get the proper apostille, which means they either have to go to the consulate to have their signature notarized.
Do I need a lawyer to do this? Can I do this on my own?
Well, so here's my thing in life. I always say, can people do things on their own? You may be able to. What you have to remember is that sometimes when you do it with the lawyer, there is an ability for the lawyer to say, here's the document, I've prepared it, here's the letter, and direct the person to do it this way. If you do it on your own, you have to make sure you're doing it, or you may be doing getting the document signed three times before you have it correct for the court. And, you know, unfortunately, the court, we used to have an ability to go in and speak to the clerks, person, you know, face to face, person to person. And in the guardianship part, they were very friendly to the people that would come in and explain what needs to be done. But though that ability with the pandemic has prohibited people, including attorneys, from going into the court and seeing clerks, my understanding is that that will soon be able to be done through a Zoom or some other form of visual audio communication that will happen in the future, but I don't know when that's going to happen. Right now, if you have questions as to what you have on your guardianship that is already established, you can email the guardianship clerk in this particular county, if it's Queens County or somewhere else, and ask them the questions. They will get back to you. As to how quickly they will get back to you, it may take a little bit of time. The courts are overloaded and things are not working in the same fashion that we did prior to the shutdown in March.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Harry, one of the questions you're asking, are the courts in Queens County still closed?
So the courts are open, but what I was just saying was the ability for you to go into the court and speak face-to-face to a clerk, that is not yet open, and that is not happening. The courts, the staff in the courthouse, as far as I understand, are in there on a sporadic basis, meaning it's not a full staff on a daily basis like it normally would be. So I would say that the answer would be the courts are open. If you have documents to drop off, what I've been told is that there are bins and the court officer will take those documents up to the particular floor of the surrogate's court on a daily basis, and it's distributed to the particular departments. But basically, you would need to email calling is not really advisable. I would say you should email the particular guardianship clerk with the questions that you have.
Thank you. Another question is, if a family completes the forms, are you available to review them?
So what I would do is I would say to people that I could consult with somebody and review forms, and charge a consultation fee if that's what is needed. But again, like I would say is that you need to be able to, the forms are just not created like, let's sit down and fill out the forms. There's a lot of different parts with it. There's affidavits of the guardian where you need to be able to answer, questions with regard to your schooling, your ability to become the guardian. So like I had said originally, there is a whole packet that you can print online from the court. And I would advise that you would print that out, try to fill it out to the best of your ability, if that was something that you wanted me to just review. But again, then you have to be able to have all of the documents in place and have everything in order for what needs to be done for the particular guardianship.
Okay. Also, will they extend the expiration date for documents signed during the pandemic?
Meaning you had documents already signed that were not, I'm going to assume it means they were not submitted to the court. So, yes, I don't foresee that to be an issue. That being said, we never know when somebody is going to say that the document is stale dated. But for the most part, if it's the physician or psychologist affidavits and it was done prior to the March shutdown, I think you would still be fine to be able to submit it.
Okay, thank you. Mary, do you have a question? I'm sorry, so you raise your hand.
I do, thank you. Thank you, Carrie. I just wanted to ask a quick question about the third party trust is the one that mom and dad established. And it says in my will that Nicholas is part of our life insurance policy will go into his special needs trust. However, we really never created one. It just states that in the will because I know that that's what it was supposed to say. So we do have to do that. But then when you said something about an inheritance going into the self-settled one, he has, Nicholas has, my brother has no children, right? We'll leave his nieces and nephews money. Can that money from that inheritance go into the third party that I create?
No. So remember that any self-settled trusts, which are trusts that have the funds of the disabled person, that those funds have come into the disabled person's name, then you're creating a self-settled trust. You can't, go ahead.
But in will, if he writes in his will that he wants Nikki's inheritance to go into a special needs trust, he can't do that?
Well, who's writing that? Nicholas? Nicholas is our disabled person, correct?
Nicholas is a nonverbal, and I'm his legal guardian.
Right.
But how do you avoid Kevin's inheritance money, his share, to go back to the government in the self-settled where in the third party one, it would go to his sisters?
Okay. So who's Kevin?
Kevin is my brother with no children.
Okay. So Kevin wants to leave money to Nicholas for Nicholas's lifetime, but at the end he wants it to go to his other nieces and nephews. Am I correct in getting your, okay. So Kevin in his will has to create a supplemental needs trust in his will. So in other words, in your will, you say, I want to leave my residuary estate to three people. One third goes to Nicholas, one third goes to one niece, one third goes to one nephew. Let's just say Kevin decides I want to leave everything to Nicholas because that's what I want to do. Those funds should be held in trust for the benefit of Nicholas, and it has to have the entire supplemental needs trust language in it. You can't just say I'm creating a supplemental needs trust. There's certain terminology that the law will look for in order for Medicaid or any other place to say, okay, this is a proper supplemental needs trust. And it's created under your brother's will. So it's created under Kevin's will, which means that Kevin is creating a testamentary supplemental needs trust with his own funds for the benefit of Nicholas. And therefore the payback or the remainder person of that trust can be his other nieces and nephews. It's only when, what we have to remember is when funds come into the disabled person's name. So let me explain it to you this way. Let's just say Kevin's will said, I give everything to Nicholas, and he never put supplemental needs trust language in his will. Now Nicholas inherits this money. It's his because he's received it when Kevin passed away, and the law says it becomes his money. Now you'd have to go to court to create that trust. To avoid that, you want the will to say it has the supplemental needs trust language in Kevin's will, which will enable Kevin to say at, when there's no more money left, or when Nicholas is passed, whatever is left goes to my other nieces and nephews.
Okay, so I get that. We all understand that the wording, right? But my thing is the special needs trust like a bank account? Like when I want to put money in it before I die, like do I go to the bank and have a place to put that?
Okay, so people could create a supplemental needs trust for the person. You're just creating a trust. So it's a document that an attorney prepares, and you're creating a trust for the benefit of the disabled person. And you could go to a bank and open a bank account or a brokerage account or any type of account in the name of the supplemental needs trust for the benefit of Nicholas. And you could put $10 in it, or you could put other monies in it. And as long as it has that language and you're creating it, but there are certain rules as to who can create it. And so it has to be created by a parent, guardian, or other individual pursuant to the law. So you have to be careful as to when it's created and who has the ability to create those trusts.
Okay, so Kevin's money in his will is going to a special needs trust, but it's not necessarily the same trust that I have for Nicholas as a third party parent trust.
That's correct. So at the end of the day, Nicholas could end up with three different trusts. You as a parent could create a trust. Your will would create a trust. Nicholas could have a self-settled payback trust from money that Aunt Sue left to him that no one told her to put the supplemental needs trust like we're telling Kevin.
Okay, so there's multiple special needs trusts for this one individual.
That's correct. That's correct.
I thought we all went jointly. Okay. That I'd like. Thank you very, very much. I'm going to get your contact at the end. Also, just on the parent note to share for guardianship is it was advised to me, and I think this is a good thing. Once you do establish guardianship, is to carry a copy of that guardianship, take a picture of it, and have it in your phone, because God forbid something happens and, you know, like you get lost in a mall and they get taken to a hospital and you go to the hospital and say, that's my son. Well, you have on your phone a document that says I'm the legal guardian of that child, because otherwise they really don't have to give your son back to you.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. That's a very good point.
That was a good point, to have it with you. And the other thing was, which someone said, is it took us a while to get guardianship because I would go get the doctor to sign the paperwork and never actually bring it to probate court, you know, or hand it to the lawyer to do. So I had to keep asking the doctor, could you rewrite this? Could you do it again? So you have a time frame of once they do that, medical forms, other than COVID, like you said, they might give them an extension. That will expire and you have to do that again.
Right. And again, if anyone is in the area of having documents ready and certain things ready, you know, you can e-file with the court, and you I would check with the guardianship clerk, but they probably, if you were doing this pro se, would allow you to mail in the actual documents and let them review it and tell you what else is missing. You know, as a practitioner, I always like to bring everything as complete as possible, and I would walk everything in to do so. But unfortunately, we are now in a changing world where that's not necessarily the way to do it. So for everyone, it's changing, including the clerks. And so we have to try to all work together to do what's best. But if you have documents statements that are sitting there, you might want to consider submitting them. And that's a great point.
Thank you, Carrie, very, very much.
You're welcome.
Beth has another question, and she said, can you explain how an ABLE account, oh, I missed it. Can you explain how an ABLE account could be an option?
Okay, so I might defer to Chris or somebody else to talk about ABLE accounts as the financial planner. ABLE accounts are options, but you need to, people are using them in lieu of, 529 accounts that you would for a typical child. So ABLE accounts are an option, but I would rather defer to somebody else to discuss that in the more of the financial planning setting.
Hi. I can definitely give you a little bit more background on the ABLE accounts, but I just do want to address one thing. Carrie, I know that you do have another prior engagement. I just want to make sure that we're still on time for you because I don't want to jeopardize that other meeting you have. If you want, I can go for your, and then if anyone has additional questions, they can always reach out to you directly. I just want to make sure that time-wise, I know you're getting very close to when you have to kind of step out.
Yeah, I'm probably good till 11 o'clock, so I can maybe field any questions, and if you want to do the ABLE accounts after me, if there's something more,
I think that's what I'll do.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Okay, thank you.
So, Carrie, where will your information be posted through CUSAC?
Well, yes, I think that they're going... I don't know if it's through CUSAC, but they're going to post it. I can always give you my email address right now for whoever wants to take it down. It's info, I-N-F-O, at K as in Kerry, O as in O'Shaughnessy, M as in Montaigne, law, L-A-W, .net.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
One more question, Kerry. I do a lot of Zoom sessions with the parents and support groups, and I always talk about special needs trust. And one of the things parents want to know is, can a parent come in and just have a conversation with you to find out if they need to build a special needs trust, if they need, how much it's going to cost them, and do you have any kind of pre-sitting or consultancy or whatever you want
So normally what I do is I have a consultation fee of $450 where I sit with people and go through what needs to be done. And if we're going to do further work, then one half of that fee is applied to the further work. And certainly if somebody emails me and I could certainly answer their email if it's a simple question and say to them, yes, I think you need to come in and we need to discuss it. I am the type of person that doesn't want anyone to do something just for the sake of having a trust if there's not a necessity to do that. And that's why I'm saying in the beginning when we talked about the personal need guardian, that's a lot of times what people just need because the child is turning 18. So if there is an ability just to do the guardianship for the personal needs, we're certainly not going to look to do anything more at this point. But it is certainly good to think about, what funds are in your child's name before they're getting to the age of 18 and what accounts you have so that there is not a necessity necessarily if there's custodian accounts that are going to turn over to them at 18, maybe you as the parent have to look at those accounts prior to that and decide what's going to be so that you're not getting into having to do a property management guardian if it's not necessary. So it's important to kind of keep, do a little homework yourself is what I'm saying. Figure out what your child has and know the time as we know passes very quickly and how all of a sudden they're going to be 18. It seems like they were two yesterday.
Thank you.
But again, I will say to everybody, I am available. Email is a great way to get in touch with me, pose your questions. And if we need to sit down and discuss things in more detail, I would advise of that. And I also, you know, as a parent, you have to look at your will, you have to address it. You know, parents of typical developing children, nobody wants to do their will because no one wants to decide who's going to be the guardian. And for children with special needs, it's so much more important to figure out who's going to be in charge of your child. And as Chris had said in the beginning, the letters of intent and what you want for your child is of utmost concern and importance. We always think we have tomorrow to do these things, but and life is so busy and hectic on a daily basis. But it's important to build that book or to build that letter or to take things one step at a time so that if something, God forbid, happens to you and you can't express it, that it's in writing and exactly what you want. And remember that things are, like we said, you've appointed, you know, your Uncle Joe, your brother Joe, who's now the uncle to Joseph, to be the successor guardian to you. You have to look at those things. Is he of advanced age? Has he moved to Alaska? Is he not the right person? So keep in mind of who are in these documents and don't think that you're married to them. The court is understanding and you can petition the court and you can say, now my 21-year-old daughter is ready to take on the challenge to be her brother's guardian if necessary. It is paperwork, it is a lot, but it can be done and you will feel better in the end if you have it all in place.
Carrie, one more question. Do you do wills?
Yes, I do do wills. We do, you know, run-of-the-mill wills, as to a lack of a better word, or wills with regard to more complex trusts for minors or the supplemental needs trust within the will. So yes, we do that. And one other thing to think about is that as a parent of a child with special needs, when something should happen to you and there's a probate of that will, it does become more complex because if it's your children who are your sole heirs, your child with special needs can't consent to that probate proceeding. So it becomes more complex in the probate court. So it is good to think about what your assets are, who your beneficiaries are, and whether you need different types of standalone trusts, such as revocable or irrevocable trust or a standalone supplemental needs trust, so that you can avoid probate if necessary.
Thank you. Any other questions? That was great.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think in just the interest of time, I know Carrie has another prior engagement. I just want to just take a minute and just really, Carrie, thank you for an amazing educational kind of a litmus of information that everyone here can kind of just kind of help get them a little more comfortable with some of the process that we talked about. Again, I just want to thank you for taking the time and just helping everyone out with this.
You're welcome. And
yes, thank you. And again,
you know, rely upon the court is my last thing I'm going to say. Whatever questions you have, if you don't get the correct answer or what you feel is a complete answer, then you obviously have a more complex situation. You have to reach out to an attorney, and I'd be glad to, you know, answer a question and help anyone that's in that need. And don't be overwhelmed by the process. Break it down into parts and everything will be fine and it will get done eventually. Thank you all for having me speak, and I hope that the information's been helpful.
Thank you so much. It was very helpful. And all her information is in the chat with the info line, which is available. So if anyone, please contact her directly. I just see one more question.
Sure.
Do you know about Kings County Surrogate Court? I guess, is it open or?
You know, each court and things change on a daily basis. So I don't want to say to you, I don't know if Kings County is open for you to physically go in, but again, you should try calling. And if not, on the websites of the court, most websites now have email addresses to each particular part of the court. And so you could email, and I think that the clerks are getting back to people more quickly by email, and probably more quickly than they ever did in the past.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You were very helpful.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me, everyone. And please let me know if there's any other questions. Please feel free to email me directly.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Chris, you're up.
So as I had mentioned, you know, the key with anything when you're looking at doing any type of project is having the right resources in place. And, you know, when Josephine had reached out to Joseph and myself, she'd asked for an attorney. And, you know, I actually wanted to make sure that I brought value added to this organization. But the one thing I tell everybody, and she had mentioned it, is that when you're sitting down to kind of take a look at this entire process, you know, she talked about a couple different aspects where you want to talk about, you know, taking a look at your own situation first, then taking a look at individual special needs, and then reaching out to the right professionals to kind of help you build that plan. You know, what I find as a financial planner, that one of the first things you want to ultimately do is take a look at your own financial situation first, evaluate that. You know, and one thing we tell everybody is looking at beneficiary audits. Meaning, and what that ultimately means is, do you have the right beneficiary arrangements on your accounts? There's been a multitude of times where I've seen ex-wives inherit life insurance policies or 401k accounts because it was never updated. That goes the same for children and adults with special needs. And again, she had talked about that, where, you know, if an individual, a family member, an aunt, a friend had left money to that individual, it may actually disrupt their benefits. And again, my sister had the same situation. We had a great aunt that passed away and left each one of her three great nieces and nephews $30,000. Me and my brother, that was a huge windfall. But for our sister, that was detrimental. It actually, you know, precluded her from getting her specific benefits from the government, and specifically around her medications, which were close to about $8,000 a month. But kind of what I want to follow up on this, and I'm going to leave about 15 minutes for questions. And I will address the ABLE account, would be, she had talked about trusts, and Mary had actually also brought up, you know, can I start putting money into a trust account? I thought this might be important to give everyone here a little bit of background on that. So you can absolutely set up these special needs or supplemental needs trust prior to to someone passing away, or even the individual needing the actual assets. What we find are most supplemental needs trusts are funded in three different manners. And there's specific tax consequences in why they're set up this way. Most trusts are actually set up with life insurance policies, meaning that in the event that an individual passes away, they leave the specific life insurance policy to the supplemental needs trust, because life insurance proceeds are tax-free. One of the worst things to leave to a supplemental needs trust is a qualified retirement account, meaning an IRA, a 457 plan, a cash balance pension plan, or 401k or 403b. And the reason being is, upon the passing of the individual, the guardian of the individual with special needs is going to need to cash in that account, pay the appropriate taxes on it, which can be as high as 37 cents on the dollar, and then put the money into the supplemental needs trust for the care of the individual. And that's just on a federal level. If you live in the city of New York, you're looking at anywhere from either 1 to 8% on the city, and you're looking at anywhere from 3 to 16% from the state. So if it's not done properly, and I've had many clients go, well, I have about $1.5 million in my 401k account, I'll just leave that to my child that has special needs. You can do that, but again, there might be larger tax consequences. Some families will also say, well, I'll leave it to my other child or the family member, and they can care for them. Here's the interesting aspect of that, and we've seen this happen multiple times. And I'll use two different examples. One is if you leave it to like another child. Unfortunately, in January, laws were changed where you can no longer do a stretch IRA. The beneficiary of an IRA that's inherited from a parent or a non-spouse now has either three options. One, take a lump sum distribution and pay tax on it. You're going to lose anywhere from high 40s to low 60s percentage-wise in taxes. Option two, you can stretch out that distribution over 10 years, paying tax on it every single year. Or option three would be, you know, creating a distribution plan within that 10-year time period, or waiting to the end of 10 years. So where, you know, those are not the best assets to leave to a supplemental needs trust. Life insurance, triple tax municipal bonds are phenomenal, because one, a triple tax municipal bond or bond fund is inside an S&T trust. It generates tax-free income. So the one problem with an S&T trust is that the tax brackets are much lower than an individual tax bracket. So for instance, as an individual, you won't hit the 37% federal tax bracket until you're about $385,000 of ordinary income. inversely, on a simple niche trust, it's a little over $12,000. Anything above that is taxed at 37 cents on the dollar. And I'll use a great example. I was brought in a couple of months ago with a family that has an adult family member that was left quite a sizable inheritance. And for many, many years, they couldn't understand why they were paying so much money in taxes. So what happened was they were working with an advisor that did not work with families or adults with special needs. And he was investing the money in stocks, mutual funds, bonds. And this account was creating an immense amount of capital gains and also short-term short-term capital gain tax and long-term capital gain tax. Some of it was taxed as ordinary income. Some of it was taxed at anywhere from 15 to 23%. So what was happening is all the gains were kind of being eaten up by taxes. When we sat down with the family, we kind of showed them a different strategy of how to structure this where you can have tax-free income from triple tax municipal bonds, and you can have deferred income inside, obviously, of life insurance vehicles or other type of deferred investment vehicles, that there wouldn't be taxable events every single year that could be disruptive to the actual trust itself. But the key is you have to make sure that when you're working with adults or children with special needs, that you're working with the right legal advisors, the right financial advisors, and also the right tax advisors. So it's kind of like you're building a team, just like anything else. If you're about to have a surgery, you're going to have your surgeon, your primary care physician, the anesthesiologist, and everyone else that's involved in this. So when we talk about setting up these type of plans or just situations, the first thing that any good financial advisor or financial planner is going to do is we're going to take a look at your overall financial situation. Then we're going to evaluate the situation of the adult or child with special needs. And we're going to help you start formulating a financial plan in that sense, or at least a roadmap. And the key there is, and again, you know, Kerry hit it on the head. What happens with all of us, we tend to get overwhelmed and we shut down. So the key is you want to make sure you're working with the right individuals that slow things down, do things as a process, and do things stage by stage, step by step, and walk you through that. You know, again, a lot of times, like myself, working with Kerry and working with individual CPAs, we tend to have conference phone calls with the families and say, okay, what's the most important thing we need to address this time? Okay, guardianship. Kerry, well, we're going to defer to you while you're working in guardianship. I'm going to work with the family and start getting an evaluation of where assets are, beneficiary arrangements, and obviously long-term expenses and goals for that individual and also for the family members. You know, I touched upon this in the beginning of it, and I said that my parents retired 10 years ago. My father actually had deferred his retirement for almost 7 years because he was building up this large investment account for my sister. And he wasn't aware that account that eventually he was going to transfer to an S&T trust for her, that it would have large tax consequences to him and to that trust if he was trying to transfer to her. And in addition to that, my dad wasn't fully aware that there were other options out there that he could have used to actually fund my sister's trust using a fraction of that money that he had saved up, and then it would actually create a larger endowment to my sister. And so what happened was me and my brother sat down with my dad, I kind of educated him on it, and we did something called a second to die policy. That policy included mom's life and dad's life, because right now my mom and dad, you know, are helping care for my sister, as along with me and my brother. In the event of their passing, that larger life insurance policy will actually fund the trust itself. That life insurance policy only took up a quarter of that pool of money that my dad had saved up and built up for my sister. And what my parents are doing now is they are actually able to enjoy a much more fruitful retirement because all that money they had built up thinking they needed it for my sister, they don't need it. They can actually use it for their own retirement. There's a lot of times sitting down with the right advisor and financial planner, they can take a look at your own financial situation and that of the individual and can help you plan specifically a course of action or a route that benefits you and benefits the individual. So a lot of times it comes down to specifically getting the right information and getting it, you know, processed the right way. Just in the interest of time, I want to make sure I answer the question on an ABLE account. So an ABLE account is also known as a 529A account. It's a tax advantage savings account for individuals with disabilities. So very similar to that of a 529 account, you can invest in the plan. What I tell a lot of individuals, on 529A accounts, advisors or advisor-driven plans or having a financial planner kind of structure may not be the best course of action. New York State offers one of the best comprehensive plans and also does it at a very, very low cost. And those plans can be overseen by your financial planner or financial advisor to make sure the investment allocations are done properly. Now, remember, these type of plans are outside the scope of taxability, meaning that if you wanted to utilize this plan to supplement the cares and needs of this individual that has special needs, you can do so. But it has to be for qualified disability expenses. You can use it for a specific type of therapeutic care. And I'll use a good example. My sister loves horses. So we have, money put aside for her in an ABLE account that we use as supplemental care for that. There are some downsides to this. You can only really contribute up to $15,000, or ultimately the beneficiary's annual wages the poverty line, federal poverty line guidelines, whichever is lower. In addition to that, the account has a cap of $100,000. So that means that if it hits over $100,000, and the individual, you're not using the funds to actually benefit the individual, you have to actually stop contributing to it. If it earns additional interest, you have to take the money out. Now, again, if it's for qualified expenses, it does not have any tax consequences. If it's not, it could have tax consequences plus a penalty, very similar to that of taking it out of a 529 account. And it does have a Medicaid payback provision. So you have to be aware that if the money goes in there, it could be there isn't the availability necessary to leave it to other beneficiaries. So you'd want to ultimately spend that down. But we're kind of getting toward the end of this. I wanted to ultimately see if anyone has any additional questions. Some of the things that I talked about, or maybe a couple other questions that maybe I didn't touch upon that they may have questions on.
Any questions? You could either verbally state it, raise your hand, or put it in the chat if it's easier.
Oh, Josie, I think everyone's kind of still in awe of Carrie's presentation.
Maybe.
Okay, yes, I have a question. I just wanted to say thank you so much for what you did, Christopher. The main thing was, I love the way you said that you put a book together, because I also put a book together, and when my son had to go into a residence, he's nonverbal, and they could read the book about his feelings, his wants, his needs, when I'm not around, how he talks, how his head moves. It was phenomenal. And I think I take my hats off to your mom doing that, because I think more parents need to do that.
So it's interesting because you bring it up too. My mom sat down with me and my brother, and there was a specific reason for that. My mom says my brother's a very emotional, warm person. She says I'm the coldest person she's ever met. And I don't think she meant that as an insult. What we did as a family, we determined that my brother would be very good for the day-to-day care of my sister, and where I would be more or less overseeing the financial aspects of my sister's care. And we still do this to this day. Me and my brother, when my mom kind of transferred that book to us, we were kind of a little taken aback by it. But now, as we've become more comfortable with this over the years, our parents aren't involved anymore. We wanted them to enjoy their retirement. And again, it's one of those things where, growing up with a sister or a family member with special needs, the burden's shared by everybody, but there are more people, there is certain people that kind of weigh a little heavy on them. And, if things are done right, the finances are done right, the legal aspects are done right, the taxation's done right, it takes the burden off of everybody. And it also gives the families the availability to shift and to pivot to changing environments. There's a lot of times where I've seen families where they plan that, Aunt Susan's going to take care of Elisa. Unfortunately, something happens where Aunt Susan is, God forbid, passes away, or she's no longer in that situation financially or emotionally or even physically able to do that. So the key here is that when you're working with the right advisors and getting the right information, they'll help you plan for every contingency. But when you're looking to plan for an adult or a child with special needs, you have to look at your own finances first and make sure that your house is in order. And then you can move to that individual. Because we've seen multiple times where, you start going through the process of getting the child or adult with special needs set up, and we're spending more time with the family or the other individuals getting their kind of finances organized and then moving on to them, which again can delay the process. One other quick thing too, I mentioned, that we're seeing that in the courts right now. I'm actually working with multiple families right now that are trying to get guardianship, and it is true. They're doing more Zoom meetings. They're doing more things virtually and via email. In Queens alone, I'm seeing things going quicker than any other county, including Nassau and Suffolk County and Kings County. Brooklyn, for lack of a better term, it seems to be a hot mess. It really does. For special needs planning, for guardianship, for letters of testamentary. And again, I'm hopeful that the courts are getting kind of their act together, but I am happy to say that Queens does seem to have the best processes in place. And I'm also noticing that the clerks are also willing to take phone calls after hours, which has blown me away, that they're willing to kind of take and, go into their own time to kind of do that. But I hope that answered your question. And thank you so much for sharing that, because it is so important that, again, if you have a letter of instruction or plans of how to care for the individual, you're going to want to do the same thing legally, financially, and tax-wise.
Chris, I see one question. Are you saying that it's not wise to put money from a parent's 401k when they die into a supplemental needs trust?
I'm absolutely saying that, because taxation-wise of that money. So let's use an example. Let's say the account is $100,000 for simple math. The trust cannot inherit an IRA or 401k account, which means that the 401k or IRA account must be cashed in, for lack of a better term. You must pay taxes on it, and then that money then has to be shifted into the trust at whatever the net amount was.
Is that
so? Most trusts are funded with life insurance or non-retirement assets. And there are a lot of individuals where we create these plans where we'll take qualified dollars, meaning IRA or 401k dollars, and we'll create a divestiture plan, meaning we'll spend that account down and we'll transfer it into a non-retirement account, which can be inherited or transferred to the supplemental needs trust at a much lower or no tax consequences. It's very similar to like leaving stocks to a supplemental needs trust. So for instance, if you leave, like, I'm going to use PepsiCo as an example. So let's say you have $10,000 worth of Pepsi stock that an individual is left. Now, the problem there is that Pepsi pays a very substantial dividend on a quarterly basis. Now, if that dividend were to exceed $12,000 and changed, then everything above that $12,000 of dividends is going to be taxed at 37 cents on the dollar on a federal level. As opposed to if that money was put into a triple tax-free municipal bond fund and that account earned $30,000, whatever it may be, that interest is 100% tax-free to the trust and it'll have no tax consequences. You find a really good supplemental needs trust has a blend of tax-deferred equity positions, meaning that they don't incur taxes until they're cashed in, and triple tax-free municipal bonds. The bonds are designed to generate income that can be used to supplement the individual's day-to-day expenses or on-demand expenses. The tax-deferred portion of it tends to be used where the trust will then cash it in when the triple tax municipal bond account, either interest is not enough or you've depleted the principal. Again, it works out to be more of a detailed plan, and every single person that we talk to is a fingerprint, a snowflake, or a very unique situation. No person, no situation is ever going to be the same when it comes to supplemental needs and special needs planning.
Thank you. Any other
questions? And one additional thing I just want to touch on. So right now, there is something called the CARES Act. So we're seeing that a lot of families with adults and children with special needs are utilizing this CARES Act, and I'll kind of go over what it is. So the CARES Act enables you to take up to $100,000 out of a qualified retirement account, meaning an IRA, 401k, 457 plan, or 403b plan. It can be taken out due to the hardships of the COVID virus. An individual can either do one of two things. They can pay that back, the $100,000, over the course of 3 years. They can actually absorb the $100,000 and pay the tax consequences over 3 years or any point in time during that three-year time period. What we find is a lot of families are utilizing that tactic to fund a special needs trust. And then they're distributing that tax consequence over 3 years for themselves so that it's not a large burden on them. So it's another strategy that we're using with family members that may have substantial 401k plans that we're thinking about leaving those assets to an individual with special needs, where you can utilize this specific advantage that the federal government, and it wasn't really envisioned for this, but we can actually use it for it. The other aspect of this too is Roth accounts will have little to no tax consequence if they're left to specifically an S&T trust. So I apologize. Hopefully that answered your question, Joseph. And if anyone has any additional questions, I'd love to answer them.
Yes, thank you. Any other questions? This was, Chris, I really want to say thank you. This was very informative, gave out a lot of information to families, and it was just great. Thank you.
Yeah, like you said, mentioned, you know, this is not a process that we do other than the fact that we're giving back to the community. I went through this where, you know, and I mentioned in the beginning, I've seen everything you could do wrong. My family did wrong when it came to special needs planning. One, my parents tried to do it on their own, and that was an absolute nightmare. It took my mom probably close to 6 months before she kind of raised her hands and just had to hire an attorney for the guardianship, because the courts don't make it easy. Can you do it on your own? Absolutely. You know, I could, theoretically, I can teach myself how to build a house, but I'm not going to do that. But the other aspect of it, too, is that, you know, when you kind of take a look at the big picture of things, for myself, you know, normally when I do these workshops, I don't wear a tie. They tend to be in person when we have the availability to do it. Tend to be smaller groups. And it's kind of just, we talk about things in general. You know, it's nothing about product. I've been to these type of events with my mom and dad back in the day where people are trying, attorneys or advisors are trying to scare you need to do this. This is how, I don't believe in fear. I'm a firm believer educating people is the right way to do things because we make better decisions when we're educated. So again, if you have questions, you know, Joe, myself, you know, I have to understand it's not just myself and Joe. We work with a huge team of specialists. So if someone throws a curveball at us, we love that. But we know that in our organization, we have the availability to answer every single question known. And if we can't, we will do everything we can within a short period of time to find an answer to that question. So again, I want to thank everybody for joining. Again, our services, the stuff that we do, these educational workshops, we can do them on smaller events. So if anyone was ever interested, we could bring in again, Carrie, for a different type of questionnaires. I can do an entire 3-hour presentation on ABLE accounts and bore everybody to death.
Thank you. Yes, we will keep it. We have recorded this. It will be available. It will be on our website. We have your information. We put up the email addresses. So if anyone wants to get in contact with them, absolutely. Very important topic that I'm actually thinking of my own topic that I have to do a special needs trust for my nephew. So we're definitely, I hear what you're saying. And thank you so much. Everybody, we're good? Anything else? I don't see any more questions. Thank you so much, Chris.
Great.
And thanks. Thank you. And Carrie, too, for bringing Carrie on, too.
Thank you, Chris. Very much.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll see you at the next session.
Yes. What time is the next session?
It's tomorrow, actually. Okay. The schedule will be on our website.
Actually, it's the Reimagining Day Services. I will be presenting with Winnie Schiff from IAC.
There you go. Everyone will get to see Josie again.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Josie.
You're welcome. Thank you. Yeah. Bye.
All right, bye.